Headlines: Palestinians hold a funeral for a teenage boy who was killed by the Israeli army in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin. Pakistan's parliament elects leader of the opposition Shehbaz Sharif as the country's new prime minister to replace Imran Khan, who lost a no-confidence vote on Sunday. And Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says Moscow will not pause its military operation in Ukraine for the next round of peace talks. Hello and welcome from our headquarters in Tehran. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumi Shahmadi and these are our top stories this hour. Palestinians have held a funeral procession for a 17-year-old man who succumbed to his injuries after Israeli forces shot him in Jenin in the occupied West Bank a day earlier. Mohammad Zakarneh's death raises the number of Palestinians killed by Israeli forces since Sunday to 4. He was among the 10 Palestinians injured by Israeli live fire amid tensions over a Palestinian retaliatory attack that killed 3 in Tel Aviv on Wednesday. Regime forces also arrested 20 others. Resistance groups in Jenin have declared a state of alert to confront Israeli raids. 2 Palestinian women and 1 man were also shot dead across the occupied West Bank on Sunday. One of them, a widowed mother of 6. Palestinians have ramped up their resistance against the regime over the past months. They say this is a legitimate response to Israeli crimes and occupation. Families of Palestinian prisoners in Gaza have held a sit-in in solidarity with their loved ones and thousands of others in Israeli custody, especially the administrative detainees. Palestinian administrative detainees have been boycotting Israeli courts for more than 100 days to protest their detention without trial. Ashraf Shannon has more.
Families of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails and prisoners' rights activists held a sit-in outside the office of the International Committee of the Red Cross in Gaza. They protested Israel's inhumane treatment of thousands of Palestinian political prisoners. Palestinian prisoners see no end in sight to their suffering, as hundreds of them are being held without charge under the so-called administrative detention, where incarceration periods can be renewed indefinitely. According to Palestinian human rights groups, the Israeli regime has issued over 50,000 administrative detention orders against Palestinians, including women and minors, since 1967.
My message for the international community is that they must put their efforts against the policies of Israel that result in suffering of our prisoners, and we wish freedom for them and all the prisoners.
According to the Commission of Detainees and Ex-Detainees Affairs, Palestinian prisoners are subjected to harsher treatment in Israeli detention centers during the holy month of Ramadan.
During the month of holy Ramadan, the Israeli occupation deprived the Palestinian detainees from organizing the collective prayers like Taraweeh and Fajr prayers. And also the food is not enough. They provide the meals with bad quantity and quality.
Solidarity with Palestinian prisoners has been a top priority for activists in Gaza, who say they are determined to stand by the prisoners for as long as it takes.
According to prisoners' advocacy groups, thousands of Palestinians, including around 500 administrative detainees, are behind bars in Israeli jails. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Pakistan's parliament elects opposition leader Shehbaz Sharif as the new prime minister amid political tensions following the ouster of Imran Khan in a no-confidence vote. Out of 342 members of the National Assembly, 174 legislators voted for Shehbaz Sharif, the younger brother of 3-time Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif. Legislators from Imran Khan's party boycotted the vote and resigned en masse from the lower house of parliament. Shehbaz Sharif will now form a new government that can remain in place until the next general election in August 2023. In a speech after his election, Sharif said that his administration will seek good ties with the U.S. and the European Union. Khan was unseated in a no-confidence motion on Sunday, over a week after several members of his ruling coalition switched sides. The ousted prime minister says he has fallen victim to a U.S.-backed regime change plot. Political commentator Saeed Mohsen Abbas believes the United States was not satisfied with Imran Khan's policies and could have orchestrated the current crisis.
Well, the turbulence is pretty much expected. The reality is that Pakistan has been sitting on two horses. They've been trying to ride the American horse as well as at the same time side up with China and now possibly even Russia. The Eurasian axis has a huge interest in Pakistan, and I think the more that Imran Khan began to move in that direction, of course, the more the Americans were going to get hugely nervous and have an anti-policy to Khan. So yes, there's every possibility that the army combined with the Americans, combined with the opposition politicians have all got involved in this to bring him down. And what you have to see is that corruption is at the core of all of these situations in Pakistan. We all know that. But, you know, for 70 MNAs or MPs basically to renege on their own party is shocking. And it calls into question partly Imran Khan's own judgment about the people that he engaged, because this is one of his vulnerabilities, that he actually formed PTI from the remnants of people who'd run away from other parties. Now, if you get people coming from the old corrupt system and you make them join your party, of course, you're more likely to have exactly what's happened to Imran Khan now, which is that those same corrupt politicians have just gone back to their erstwhile brothers that they worked with before, and they've done it for money. No.
The Russia-Ukraine war has entered its seventh week. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says that his country would not halt its military operation for the next round of peace talks. Lavrov says Russia has suspended military action during the first round of talks, but he says Moscow will no longer pause operations, as it is convinced Ukrainian forces will not reciprocate. Moscow and Kiev have held several rounds of negotiations without major breakthroughs. Russia says peace talks are not progressing as rapidly as they could be. Moscow accuses the West of trying to derail negotiations by raising war crimes allegations against Russian troops. In the meantime, the Ukraine says that they are bracing for major Russian military offensives in eastern Donbass region. That also has been confirmed by the head of the self-proclaimed Donetsk Republic, who pledged to intensify operations to liberate the region. The region includes the cities of Luhansk and Donetsk, which are under control of pro-Russian groups. And Ukraine says 9 humanitarian corridors have been agreed for Monday between Kiev and Moscow to evacuate people from the besieged eastern regions. The planned corridors include 5 in the Luhansk region. 1 corridor is for people evacuating by private vehicles from the city of Mariupol. Ukraine says around 2,900 were evacuated through humanitarian corridors on Sunday. The UN says the conflict has so far displaced 7.1 million people inside Ukraine. The body also says that over 4.5 million Ukrainians have fled the country since the Russian offensive started. According to UN figures, 90% of the refugees are women and children, as Ukrainian authorities do not allow men of military age to leave the country. Poland hosts the largest number of refugees. The European Union is said to be working on a draft proposal that could potentially target Russia's oil sector in response to its military offensive in Ukraine. The foreign ministers of Ireland, Lithuania, and the Netherlands revealed that a process is underway, but said there is still no agreement to ban Russian crude. Ahead of a ministerial meeting in Luxembourg, they said that the 27-member bloc is looking at ways for an oil embargo. The European Parliament last week voted for such a measure, although the decision was not binding. The bloc relies on a quarter of its oil imports from Russia as it comes up with a wave of sanctions targeting hundreds of Russian people and entities since the war was launched on Ukraine. In response, Moscow has also announced retaliatory measures against European countries. And in France, final results of the first round of the presidential elections show incumbent Emmanuel Macron and his far-right contender Marine Le Pen would face a runoff on April 24th. Macron won more than 27% of the votes, while Le Pen came second with over 23%. The results show a repeat of the 2017 runoff between the same candidates. However, this year, the gap between the two has become much closer. Opinion polls forecast a victory for Macron with 55% of the votes. Macron and Le Pen have campaigned on sharply opposing agendas. Le Pen pledged radical domestic and international changes for the country, but Macron criticizes her approach as the one aligned with populists and xenophobes. He calls the upcoming weeks a decisive period for the future of France and Europe.
The first round of the French presidential election is finished, and as expected, there will be a repeat of 2017. Emmanuel Macron and Marine Le Pen will duel once again in the second round of voting.
Maybe the French people will surprise everyone and elect Marine Le Pen. This is her second time making it to the second round, and maybe people will give her a chance. But I think Macron will win because too many people are either scared to vote for Le Pen or feel they will be disappointed by her.
I think Macron is brilliant and that he has handled the coronavirus crisis very well. Le Pen is too racist and too extreme right.
Macron's team brushed off recent polls that actually have Le Pen winning in the second round, as she has soared in the last month to make the race a dead heat.
Now everything begins. We need to explain the project we had for the five coming years with the president, because the president was not in a position to completely explain his project. He was at work for the French people because of the Ukrainian crisis.
In a close third place, just 1% behind Le Pen, was Jean-Luc Mélenchon, a former Socialist Party minister who turned left. In a bid to win over centrists, he didn't embrace the yellow vests, and barring a huge cache of votes somewhere, he's headed home and perhaps has aged out of politics. In fourth place, with a disappointing 7%, was mainstream media pundit Eric Zemmour, who was seemingly given control of the campaign agenda for months, despite setting new lows in Islamophobia and racism. The mainstream conservative candidate, Valérie Pécresse, was a distant fifth. The so-called Sarkozyist candidate didn't even get the endorsement of former President Nicolas Sarkozy. The once mighty Socialist Party might be finished after garnering less than 2%, and only the two communist candidates scored less. Finishing a surprising seventh was Jean Lassalle, the only MP to wear a yellow vest in French Parliament. Parliament immediately suspended itself, and Lassalle was fined.
Is Le Pen still so shocking after 5 years of Macronism and in a post-Donald Trump world? Has Macron provided enough stability in a post-coronavirus landscape? We'll have the verdict of France's voters on April 24th. Romain Mazahari, Paris.
Iraq has called for the dismantlement of a refugee camp controlled by U.S.-backed Kurdish militants near the Iraqi border in Syria. Baghdad says the camp, which houses thousands of Daesh terrorists, poses a real threat to Iraq's national security. The U.S. presence there, with the stated aim of eliminating Daesh terrorists, is seen by many as just a cover for Washington to maintain its illegal presence in Syria.
Al-Hawl camp is located 15 kilometers away from the Syrian-Iraqi border. It is the largest camp of Daesh elements and is controlled by the U.S.-affiliated Syrian Democratic Forces. The militants are holding tens of thousands of people in Al-Hawl camp, East Hasaka City. They run it in cooperation with U.S. occupation forces, including thousands of Daesh terrorists of different nationalities and their families, whom Washington invests and employs to implement its plans in the region. Meanwhile, Iraq's national security advisor, Qasem al-Araji, has expressed concern about the possibility of the release of Daesh elements and leaders from prisons controlled by U.S.-backed Kurdish militants in eastern Syria. He says Daesh has made numerous attempts to break such prisons since most of the terrorist group's leaders are incarcerated there. He has frequently met with U.S. officials and United Nations envoys to stress the need to resolve the issue of the Al-Hawl refugee camp in the northeastern Syrian province of Hasaka. The senior Iraqi official called on foreign governments to repatriate their citizens from Al-Hawl and urged a rapid dismantlement of the camp. Daesh began a terror campaign in Iraq in 2014, overrunning vast swathes in lightning attacks. Iraq declared victory over Daesh in December 2017 after a three-year counter-terrorism military campaign, which also had the support of neighboring Iran. The remnants, though, keep staging sporadic attacks across Iraq, attempting to regroup and unleash fresh violence. Daesh has intensified its terrorist attacks in Iraq since January 2020, when the United States assassinated top Iranian anti-terror commander Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and deputy commander of Iraq's popular mobilization units, Abu Mahdi al-Mohandes, near Baghdad International Airport. The Iraqi anti-terror resistance groups have repeatedly warned Baghdad that the remnants of Daesh active in Syria's U.S.-occupied east may find unhindered access to the Iraqi border and infiltrate into its western Anbar province. This is while the positions of the PMU and its affiliated resistance groups operating against Daesh in the border regions have repeatedly come under attack by the U.S. military over the past years.
The United States funnels money into these groups, into these very kind of ethno-nationalist and separatist organizations that are against the current government of, in this case, Syria. And of course, the government of Syria happens to be very anti-U.S., so naturally, the United States is going to fund groups that want to topple the government of a given country that opposes NATO, that opposes to the West, that opposes U.S. dominance.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, close up, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. I am now in Tehran, standing by the Chitgar River. When you live in a busy, crowded city like Tehran,
then walking by this artificial river could be very enjoyable. Of course, nothing is like a natural scenery. It's been for a long time that I haven't had a tour to the beautiful nature of Iran, and honestly, I really miss those amazing sceneries. So, today I'm going to take a tour to Bandar Mahshahr in southern Iran in order to visit the beautiful region of Horemusa. I'm sure you'll like it. Horemusa is one of the firths of the Persian Gulf. Hor, literally firth, means a long, narrow indentation of the seacoast. Horemusa is a triangular firth northwest of the Persian Gulf. Horemusa is 20 to 50 meters deep. However, its depth reaches 73 meters in some points. This depth has made it possible for the ships weighing up to 70,000 tons to easily move along this canal. Horemusa has small branches on its western side. The oil tankers which move toward Bandar Imam Khomeini have to sail through Horemusa. This canal is one of the most important natural canals of Iran. North of this canal, there are Bandar Imam Khomeini, Bandar Mahshahr, Sarbandar, and Petrochemical Special Economic Zone of Mahshahr. I am now at Bandar Mahshahr. The weather is pleasant, though a little bit humid. Horemusa is connected to the Persian Gulf, and I feel really excited to see it. Here's the magnificent Persian Gulf. The smell that comes from the Persian Gulf is the most pleasant scent I've ever experienced in whole of my life. Here we have the Persian Gulf and Horemusa. Let's get closer to the sea. Actually, Horemusa has a diverse flora and fauna. The fauna includes humpback dolphins, flamingos, crested terns, sternidaes, small crabs and fish of different types, as well as lots of beds of different types, which are hard to count. Because of its unique nature, Horemusa is an ideal tourist attraction for nature lovers. Oh my God, look at there! Several dolphins are playing at a far distance. I have to ride in a boat in order to see them very well. Dolphins don't approach the seacoast. The reflection of the sun ray on the dolphin's skin makes you think that each time that one of them jumps out of the water, a piece of gold is jumping. Oh, I can't take my eyes off all the beauties of the Persian Gulf.
Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Economic divide.
Russia has required its payments from energy sales to what it deems as unfriendly countries to be made in rubles. Its critics say that this is absurd and against their contractual obligations. Or is it a stroke of genius to bypass U.S. sanctions and strengthen Russia's national currency? Just two of the angles we'll be covering in this edition of Economic Divide. Coming up in today's program, Putin issues a warning or tells Europe, pay in rubles or we'll cut off your gas. Western nations reject the switch from the currency. In its, their gas deals, Europe is already struggling to find alternative supplies. Europe facing the prospect of losing more than a third of its gas supply. Germany, the most heavily reliant, has activated an emergency plan that could mean rationing in Europe's biggest economy. We'll see if that happens. And finally, we will take a look at energy exports and how Putin is using that to be its most powerful tool against sanctions, while at the same time propping up the ruble. That means buyers of Russian gas must open ruble accounts in Russian banks. That's right, it's a new world order.
The crisis between Russia and Ukraine has already changed the geopolitics of Europe, and it's altered economic and political relations between Russia and the West. The U.S. and its allies have already imposed several rounds of sanctions on Russia. They include freezing Russian assets and cutting Moscow off from the global banking system. In retaliation, Russian President Vladimir Putin has ordered the government, the Central Bank, and Gazprom Bank to develop the necessary tools to switch all payments for Russian natural gas from unfriendly states to rubles. This includes countries that have targeted Russia's financial system and seized its foreign reserves in response to the crisis in Ukraine. Economists said the move is designed to try to support the ruble, which has collapsed against other currencies. This move is aimed to some degree to skirt and avoid the U.S. and European sanctions. But some analysts expressed doubt that it would work. The group of seven major economies have agreed to reject Moscow's demand to pay for Russian natural gas exports in rubles. Germany has said payment in ruble is not acceptable. It has urged the companies affected not to follow President Putin's demand. It's feared that Russia would turn off the taps now, but Germany says it's prepared for all scenarios. Yet, Europe's threats may be just hot words. After all, around 40% of Europe's oil and gas is imported from Russia. Germany is one of the most reliant EU states. U.S. promises of providing Europe's energy needs is easier said than done, especially when it comes to transport.
So will the Russian President Vladimir Putin's plan work, making unfriendly countries pay in rubles for Russian gas? Let's take a look at what people thought about it online on social media. This post said this is how serious Russia and the President Vladimir Putin are about this decision. If Europe decides not to pay in ruble, then Russia will shut down gas supplies. As a result, the existing contract will be terminated and void. Any decision to buy gas from Russia in the future will be a new contract that could be at a much higher shot price. Next post, the Russian foreign minister says a new reality is taking shape. The unipolar world is irretrievably receding into the past, and a new world is being born. He goes on to say that nobody on earth will be considered a second-rate player. All nations are equal and sovereign. Now, look at what countries are doing to counter this. The U.S. has said that it would release its oil reserves, 1 million barrels per day. Now, this person has said someone should tell the U.S. that strategic oil reserves are there for emergency situations, not to try and lower gas prices. Well, this tweet shows how Russia is on the winning side when it comes to its gamble. The ruble recovers. A scared Europe is losing the financial war as Europe's gas and oil payments continue to finance the Russian army. Insane. Double down on sanctions now. Okay, some of the online posts there. Well, let's find out what our guests think in this section of the Q&A. Max Perry is an independent investigative journalist and a geopolitical analyst who joins us from New York. Max Perry, welcome. Russia demanding payments for its natural gas in rubles from unfriendly countries. Obviously, the countries that have placed sanctions against them, adding that trust in the dollar and the euro has been compromised. And that is something that has occurred because of the West seizure of Russian assets also. What do you think the significance of this demand is? And what about the game plan that President Vladimir Putin has when it comes to the payment in rubles?
Well, first of all, I think that this demand by Russia represents a real game changer here in terms of the global financial order. The implementation of these anti-Russian sanctions, I think we can already see the beginning of their boomerang effect, so to speak, where that it's already having, not just on the United States, but also the European Union. And it could mark a real turning point, because we're seeing a wave of de-dollarization and, you know, the abandonment by other countries of reserve currencies, like not just the dollar, but also the euro. And, you know, this, the ushering in of an era of local currencies like the ruble, which, you know, could potentially shape, reshape the world economic order and mark the end of U.S. dollar hegemony.
All right, let's bring in Mark Sloboda now. He is an international affairs and security analyst who's based in Moscow, who joins us. Mark Sloboda, welcome. The move by Russia is aimed, obviously, to some degree, to bypass the U.S. sanctions and also the European sanctions. In terms of how Russia is approaching this is what I want to ask from you, and how that's going to affect the dollar, whether it's going to knock the value of the dollar down in any respect, and whether you're going to see countries that are actually then increased their trade in national currencies.
So Russia is using an extensive toolbox, the capital controls they have, the limiting of commodities for export, as well as this move to start pricing gas and their other commodities in the rubles and only accepting rubles for the change. It is a precedent. It's not one that can be used by every country that suffers Western sanctions, simply because Russian commodities, the European countries are so dependent on them to such a large degree that this makes it possible, because they really have no other choice. But it will lead, again, to a splintering of dollar hegemony around the world, without, you know, shattering it overnight, such that countries will increasingly start to trade in each other's currencies and other reserve currencies of value to maintain their foreign policy independence.
It is time for our Info News section of the program, where we review other economic news from around the world. Our first news story concerns the IMF, who has issued a warning: anti-Russian sanctions may weaken the U.S. dollar. Now, the IMF said the dollar would remain the major global currency, even in that landscape. But fragmentation at a smaller level, according to what the IMF has said, is certainly quite possible, meaning the restrictive measures could propel the formation of what it calls smaller currency trade deals. On to our next topic, U.S. child poverty, a story that was bad news for children in the U.S. U.S. Congress had actually found an easy way to fix child poverty, but then it walked away. Lawmakers ended a program that gave money to families in need, fearing that the money would go for non-essentials, things like cigarettes and alcohol. So bad news for children who are in poverty in America. Up next, U.S. energy profits. Who says the U.S. isn't profiting from the Ukraine crisis? U.S. oil companies, was reported, are set to reap up to $126 billion in extra profits amid the special military operation in Ukraine by Russia. It's high time for Congress, according to the report, to pass a windfall profits tax and prevent the fossil fuel industry from harnessing a war to make billions. That's according to one campaigner. All right, finally, Iran's economy recorded 4.1% growth in the first 9 months, according to Iran's central bank. Now, this is quite a feat for a country under sanctions. And it proves that Iran's president is right when he says that Iran's, or the people, Iranians' livelihood, that is not tied to the economy nor to the JCPOA Vienna talks. Obviously, that has paid off based on the GDP growth. Well, those were some of the stories that we picked.
Listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
So what is the big fuss anyways about Russia wanting its payments in rubles? I mean, money is money, isn't it? Well, if it were only that simple. Now, in this in-depth section, we will explain Russia's game plan. Hopefully, you'll understand it. Now, one of the reasons behind Russia's move to want ruble payments is to make sure that the ruble does not lose its value. When the special military operation began, the ruble's value fell dramatically to 85 to the euro, and then it went to 110. Only after the intervention by the Russian Central Bank, it stood at 94.12 the euro. Now, let's move on to the next item, countries that Putin expects to pay for gas in rubles. It lists them as unfriendly countries. You're going to see some of those countries, or all of those countries, which obviously are the countries that have imposed sanctions. We're looking at UK, Japan, Canada, Norway, Singapore, South Korea, Switzerland, and, of course, the UK. Now, it's noteworthy to say that some, including the U.S. and Norway, do not actually buy Russian gas. Now, at this point, let's take a look at the currency volume and the type of currency that's involved to see how large a volume that is for Russia. Well, in the year 2020, the EU was Russia's primary trading partner. According to Gazprom, 58% of its sales of gas, which goes to Europe, were settled in euros. The U.S. dollars accounted for about 39%, according to Gazprom sales. And then you have the next unit of money, which is the pound sterling, and that stood at 3%. Interesting to note here, gas imports to the EU from Russia, there are a lot. They account for 800 million euros or 680 million pounds. That's daily spending. Every day that money is spent. So that's a large amount of money that's being transacted. So what are the requirements for this ruble payment to take place? Well, we know that the Russian President Vladimir Putin has said you have to pay in rubles. That is something that started this whole thing off. How then it transpires, dollar and euro payments are made to a non-sanctioned Russian bank. That bank, Gazprom, is at this point designated. The bank will open two accounts as a result of what it has done and enacted, one in rubles, then another one in foreign currency. And we're going to tell you in a second why that is. But those are the two steps that they need to take. Now, the buyers, they are going to pay in foreign currency. That's the wiggle room that has been allowed here, and that's very important. So the bank will sell the foreign currency on Moscow's currency exchange. So money will be made there also for Russia. The rubles will be placed in the rubles account after it's exchanged or it is transformed to the unit of money, rubles. So that's how this whole process takes place. All right, let's try to get some sense out of this and an analysis on this. Our guests joining us, rejoining us will be Mark Sloboda. He's an international affairs and security analyst based in Moscow. Mark Sloboda, Russia demanding payments for its natural gas in rubles for unfriendly countries. We know that. Russia has said that trust in the dollar and the euro had been compromised. Tell us more about how that has occurred, and if you agree, and what is the significance of this Russian demand overall?
Basically, what this is doing is Russia is saying that we have existing contracts with European companies and other countries to supply gas, but the currency with which you are paying us is now worthless to us because you have made them it worthless by your sanctions. This is a force majeure, and it is demanded then of us to only accept payments in a currency that we can actually, use, rubles, because you've frozen our assets overseas. We're not going to give you, you're not going to give us more money that you're just going to freeze our assets. And we're not going to give away the gas for free. And this will be done via a Russian bank, Russian Gazprom bank, where the buyers of Russian gas will have to open an account where they will deposit the payments in dollars or euros. This will be sold internal to the bank on an exchange for rubles. The rubles will then be credited to the gas producer, Gazprom itself.
All right, there you have Mark Sloboda. Max Perry also rejoins us now, independent investigative journalist and a geopolitical analyst. Max Perry, the move that Russia has actually enacted is aimed to some degree to actually want to obviously bypass these U.S. sanctions and the European sanctions. But I think Russia has other tools in its toolbox. Perhaps you can tell us about that, because we're looking at the way that Russia is going about this. Do you think that it's going to undermine the dollar as it hopes to do? And to what degree do you think that will be?
Yes, I think this is definitely a strategy aimed at counteracting the sanctions and bypassing American economic warfare. And this, you know, that's been a pattern in the advent of this multipolar world we've seen emerging, where, for example, a country like Iran, which is under these maximum pressure sanctions, or Venezuela, which is also under embargo, you know, this, in addition to the fact that these sanctions have not produced the regime change that these countries are targeted for, you know, these global South countries that have been in the gun sights of imperialism, but those countries have been able to bypass those sanctions by integrating themselves with Russia and China's Eurasian economic infrastructure, which has been built independent of, you know, dollar hegemony. And so for a perfect example is how ironic it was that the United States had to reach out to Venezuela and reach out to Caracas to potentially allow oil purchases, and they may even in the future end up lifting the sanctions that they had placed on Venezuela because these sanctions that they've now placed on Russia are going to have such an impact on the global financial market on energy. So how ironic is that plot twist? So I think you know, part of the pattern here with this multipolar world that's emerging is that we're seeing, you know, countries like Russia or Iran or Venezuela be able to get around the U.S. and its economic warfare.
Different estimates of the impact of a gas boycott or embargo on Europe, but most involve a substantial loss of economic output, especially since the war and the resulting surge in energy and raw material prices is already weighing on Europe's economy. It appears the U.S. is trying to benefit from the Ukraine crisis to its own benefits. The crisis could also push Europe to buy the raw material it needs from the U.S. instead of Russia. That includes agricultural products like grain and mineral commodities like nickel and aluminum. Russia has other tools to skirt Western sanctions. It's eyeing closer cooperation with countries like Iran and China. According to recent data from the Russian Federal Customs Service, as of January 2022, China accounted for 19% of all Russian trade. That is more than twice the value of Russia's trade with its next largest market, Germany, with 7.4%, and almost six times the value of its trade with the U.S., with 3.3%. The U.S. embargo on advanced chips is likely to have far-reaching consequences for Russia's military and industrial development over the long term in Russia. A surge in demand from Russia could provide the necessary impetus for this sector's further development in China. Sanctions on Russian exports also secure cheap food and energy, adding impetus to plans that were already underway before the Ukraine war. The cooperation between Moscow and Beijing could push China and Russia to use their own currencies in their bilateral trade. And this can weaken the global dominance of the dollar.
So, are there any benefits to paying in rubles, or will European countries actually suffer a loss because of this? That depends on a country's imports. In the case of the European Union, for the year 2021, imports increased to a record high, increasing by 23%, with exports increasing by 13%. What does this mean? Well, for one thing, it means that businesses are finding themselves making more payments to foreign suppliers, which brings us to the question, what's more optimal, paying in euros or US dollars, or paying in the supplier's local currency? The answer to that question should be pretty straightforward. What makes more economic sense? And the answer may surprise you. For European businesses, setting invoices in euros or US dollars may seem the easiest, most hassle-free way to pay. However, there may be benefits to paying invoices in the supplier's local currency. Some of those include earning discounts on purchases, extending payment terms, fixing payment amounts and settlement terms, and improving trading partner relationship. Just think about it. For years, the majority of European imports have been invoiced and paid in euros and US dollars. This is what the head of the Foreign Exchange Bank has said. The reality is that paying invoices in the currency of the originating supplier isn't so complicated, and it can have benefits. After all, you are offering a convenience to your supplier. There can be value in that. If that isn't enough to make buyers think twice before making payments in euros or dollars, maybe this would. If foreign suppliers are billing in euros or in US dollars, they're typically going to pad the price of goods by up to 2% or more. So, in the case of Russia, it has required energy commodities to be paid in rubles. So, why not other products, you may ask? Well, just before recording this program, Russia made that announcement also. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov has said that a ruble payment scheme that Russia currently uses with gas would be extended to new groups of goods in the future. So, there you have it. As you can see, paying then in rubles is not that bad if the proper diplomatic and non-aggressive approach is used, especially when it comes to Russia.
My final comments, let me ask you a question. Who tells you how much your currency is worth? The United States? Europe? Think about it. The White House owns the dollar. The European Parliament owns the euro. And Downing Street owns the pound. They sure use their currencies how they want it, especially the United States, which has weaponized the dollar against other countries. Russia owns the ruble, and it can decide how much it's worth. And more good news for the ruble, Russia may soon back it with gold. That does it for this edition of Economic Divide. It was great having you on board. Questions and comments, we always look forward to them. For me, Kavit Tatwai, it's goodbye. Until the next program.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.